Global Connections Television is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guests. We invite you to go to the website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous shows. If you're involved with a PBS or community access television station or an educational institution that has an intra-campus television hookup, or perhaps a podcast or just a computer and would like to share the programs, please feel free to do so. Global Connections is provided at no cost to help people in the U.S. and worldwide better understand how international issues impact our lives.
Welcome to today's Global Connections program. I'm Bill Miller. Today, we're going to be taking a look at international trade and commerce and how important it is and some of the interesting complications. My guest is an expert on this topic. Dr. Dale C. Copeland is a professor of international relations with a focus on trade, war, and economic interdependence. His most recent book is A World Safe for Commerce, American Foreign Policy from the Revolution to the Rise of China. Dr. Copeland, welcome to today's Global Connections program.
Well, it's great to be here, Bill.
I appreciate you being with me. Let's just jump right into it. This is an extremely important topic, very timely. Why did you decide to write it at this point in time?
Well, I'd published two previous books on rise and decline of great powers and how commerce affects the likelihood of conflict or peace. The first book was called The Origins of Major War, and the second one's simply called Economic Interdependence and War. And I had to think about a third book, and the question of U.S.-China was really front and center for me. This is about 6 years ago. And I became very worried, to be honest, about us getting into a new Cold War where we might start to cut China off from trade as we did to the Soviet Union during the previous Cold War. And that might lead China, very dependent, to start acting like maybe Japan in 1940-41 when it got cut off from raw materials and access to markets. And of course, we know what happened. They hit Pearl Harbor in the Philippines and Southeast Asia. And a repeat of that conflict, which I knew very well from the previous book, Economic Interdependence and War, was really kind of obsessing me, to be honest. And I thought, okay, how can I write an important book about American foreign policy that captures the dynamics and risks involved in how trade affects U.S. behavior and the behavior of other great powers and how that might lead us into a war with China or a conflict, or simply actually be the critical foundation for continued peace?
Mm-hmm. And I noticed in your book that that trade dynamics really play a role as far as how a country will interact with other countries as for peace or conflict, whichever the case may be. How does that apply to the United States? And are there a couple of examples?
Well, we could go back, as I do in the book, historically, and look at the deep history of U.S. foreign policy or American foreign policy. I started in 1750, which surprised me. I thought I was going to start in 1850. But I kept pushing it back because I realized, my gosh, these cases, the U.S.-Mexican War, 1846, the War of 1812, and even the Revolutionary War had very, very strong connections to commerce, American commerce with the rest of the world. Of course, in the Revolutionary War, it was, or prior to that, it was the commerce with Britain, and Britain being the master, if you will, and we were the colonies. But I tried in this book to cover pretty well every single case. Took me 7 years. Took every single case that America has had a relationship with another great power or two where it led to conflict or indeed to peace. For example, the end of the Cold War with Gorbachev, and asked the simple question, to what extent was commerce driving those behaviors, both on our side, but also on the other side? And how did that interaction, in fact, between the other great power and the emerging great power of the U.S. or the superpower that U.S. became after 45, how did those interactions lead to either peace or to conflict? So that was the sort of driving force of the history. Maybe you want to ask a follow-up question, because I'd love to be more specific about what you'd like me to talk about.
Oh, no, please. It's your show. You be as specific as you would like. Go right ahead. And if you have an example please.
Okay, well, let me give a couple of examples from the book.
Okay, sure.
That are very relevant and sometimes surprisingly relevant to U.S.-China today. Let me talk about the basic dynamic first of U.S.-China as I see it. In the early 90s or even the early 80s, China was maybe one-tenth, at most one-twentieth of the size of the U.S. economy. And we all know that it's caught up. And it's caught up largely through a trade-driven grand strategy. China has almost 40% of its GDP locked up in exports and imports. That's the highest level that any great power has had since about 1905 with the British. And the British got to 40% or 45% because they had all this trade with colonies, which they controlled. China's trade is with people who they don't control and, in fact, are typically in the U.S. sphere of influence. So that makes China a very worried great power about its own economic growth trends. But the worry is also on the part of the U.S. because they see this rising economic giant, technologically now very sophisticated, not a, quote, developing country anymore, although sometimes China likes to use that phrase. And we worry that China will indeed overtake us in total power, maybe even in technological power. And that, in my history readings from my previous two books and in this book, tends to be a recipe for conflict, not war, but for struggles, for worries about the rise of a rising power or the growing power's long-term strength. And of course, the rising power worries that it might be cut off or restricted, as Japan was in 40-41, and then hit its own peak of power too early and start to decline. So if you see where I'm going with this, we see a dynamic in history that the rising power wants to grow, use trade typically to keep that growth going, as China has been doing and wants to continue to do. And it's up to the declining state, in this case, the U.S., to decide whether it wants to restrict that trade, which is giving the riser such growth, or to allow that growth, even at the risk of allowing that rising state to overtake us, or in this case, the U.S. So let's just look at a couple of quick examples, because there's some fascinating ones. Think about why the British allowed the U.S. to become the reigning superpower of the political economy world, at least, by about 1890. The British had lost its hegemonic or dominant position by about 1880, but by 1890-95, the U.S. was clearly the world's largest economy. Not militarily, the British were still the naval dominant power, but the U.S. was clearly growing, and the British did not start a war with the U.S. So that's kind of a puzzle, and we can come back to why it didn't. But in a lot of other cases in world history, the state that's declining does start either a major war or a constraining policy like we did against the Soviet Union to cut them off from trade to prevent their growth. And it might be surprising to some of your watchers or listeners to know that by 1959, we had about $1 million in trade with the whole of the Soviet Union, like almost nothing. And in fact, in 1961, a first memo to Kennedy was saying, hey, maybe we just start trade relations with the Soviets to try to buy their cooperation, make them moderate their missile buildup and be nicer in the third world and so forth. And guess what they wanted to start with, Bill? They wanted to start with, how about we relax our restrictions on crab meat and vodka? That's how restrictive we were. We weren't even trading air conditioners because we thought that would give the Soviets some kind of strange advantage in technology over the long term. But crab meat and vodka, okay, we can do that, maybe. And they didn't, but they thought about it. Well, let's go back and talk about the case that really, in some ways, other than Japan 41, is the closest parallel to today, where you have a declining power that in this case, 1941, was Japan, because it was being cut off from oil and raw materials, and a rising power, back in 41, it was still the U.S. And what happened? Well, Japan started a major war in the Pacific to get the raw materials and commerce and markets it needed. Now, I can go on just a little bit longer, just if you'd like, to talk about what happened in the Revolutionary War. Now, this is a fascinating case. I'm a Canadian, by the way, so I did not grow up with the American Revolution and the language of taxation without representation and so forth that Americans learn in high school. But what I did as I studied this case, going back to 1750, is I realized that the Americans were very well aware of their growth. They were doubling their economy and their population every 15 to 20 years. And that's, of course, compounded. So it was quadrupling every 40 years. And they were also more wealthy in per capita income than the British public. So what was going on? Well, the British were starting to worry by 1740s that this growing British North American area of our 13 colonies would overtake the British and shift the balance of power away from London towards the east coast of North America. It's hard to believe, but this is exactly what was going on. And Benjamin Franklin in 1751 was so concerned with this talk, he decided to write a public article that was published in 1754 in London about this and say, don't worry, we're growing. We're going to overtake you, sure, but we're loyal British subjects. And yes, maybe the shift of balance of power will make the East Coast the center of your British Empire, but that's okay because we're loyal British subjects. Well, you can guess what's going on in Britain. They think that's rhetoric, and they also wonder if the Americans will be as fully committed to being part of the empire once they're dominant, and will they be as nice after they've overtaken the British? And guess what? You get by 1762, in the midst of a war with France, a shift in British policy, a way to keeping the Americans down, the British North Americans, keeping them from growing, making sure they couldn't industrialize, making sure that through taxation, yes, but also restrictions on currency, restrictions on manufacturing, restrictions on who they could and could not trade with, that they would keep the Americans, in the phrase of the time, hewers of wood and drawers of water. In other words, suppliers of raw materials and staple goods, while the British would supply all the industrial products. That was a good relationship for Britain, and it would keep America down. The Americans didn't want that. And that was, as I show in great detail, especially through Sam Adams' three volumes of diary notes and letters, I show that the Sam Adams and the Jeffersons of the world were very aware of what the British were up to. And they were very upset. As a Virginian, Thomas Jefferson, I'm at the University of Virginia, of course, and Department of Politics. But the University of Virginia's Thomas Jefferson, he started the school, was very upset with the British policy about tobacco tariffs and the fact that he had to trade his valuable tobacco and other products to Britain first with duties before it could be traded to Europe. And these restrictions were keeping America weak, relatively weak. And they were growing, so they wanted to have more openness. And ultimately, the British said, we won't let that happen. And the Americans felt they had to up the ante. And so from 1774, the first Congress in Philadelphia, to 1775 and 1776, the ratcheting up of tension got to the point where it was inevitable that it would lead to war. But why is that relevant? Because the Chinese worry that the Americans will adopt such a policy of, I would call it, a glass ceiling on their growth through economic restrictions. And the Chinese have now built enough of a navy to be able to defend their own long-term global economic interests in the face of this very potential for American restrictions. Good news, though. Good news. If you give the other rising state the assurances you're not going to do that, and Biden has done this very directly by saying, we're not decoupling, we're not going to cut you off, except for, you know, under 15 nanometer chips from China, from Taiwan and South Korea, we're going to restrict those. But everything else, we're still open to trade. And that's a very good thing, because that actually gives China the confidence in the midst of economic problems at home, gives China the confidence that it can indeed keep growing and stabilize its own domestic support for the Communist Party, which is also a critical part of this.
That's a very good description. And when you were describing the situation between an imperial, what we'll call an imperialist, or the European powers, when they controlled various colonies in Indonesia and Portugal had colonies in various parts of Africa, well, in Asia too, to some degree. And you saw that's exactly the relationship they wanted. They wanted to keep their colonies supplying the raw materials because then they could produce the final products. And of course, the value added of the final product is much higher than a piece of timber or oil or something like that. That's exactly the relationship they had, and they wanted to keep it. And maybe China can take solace in the fact that they're not one of our colonies. We're just competing with them when it comes to trade, and they're not one of our colonies. Well, we're going to come back in just a minute and talk about some more of the challenges. Well, you're watching Global Connections Television, which is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guest. We'd invite our viewers to go to our website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous programs. Also, if you're involved with a PBS or community access television station, or you have a podcast, or you just have a computer and you like our programs and you would like to share them, please feel free to do so. Global Connections Television is provided at no cost as a public service to help us better understand international issues and how they impact our lives. Today, we're taking a look at the delicate relationship between countries and how they handle their trade relations with one another. My guest is an expert on this topic. Dr. Dale Copeland is a professor of international relations with a focus on trade, war, and economic interdependence. His most recent book is A World Safer Commerce, American Foreign Policy from the Revolution to the Rise of China. It's been said for years, Dr. Copeland, that trade is absolutely essential to promote better understanding and also to raise the standard of living, the quality of life for people at hopefully at both ends of the trading cycle. And I think that's very much the case, but it's still there are areas where they will never always agree on everything, I'm sure. And they'll think that one's trying to take advantage and that type of thing. But today we hear so much. Well, first off, I guess you get the same misinformation at the University of Virginia I'm getting where I live, in this misinformation about this globalization that's taking supposedly is taking place. There is globalization. There's no doubt about that. But there's so much bad information about how destructive globalization is and how you've got globalists who are trying to run Americans' lives and that type of thing. But there are so many myths out there. How do you deal with these myths? What are some of the ones that you hear and how do you deal with them?
Well, I like to think that behind every myth, there's a particle of truth. And my larger perspective, in fact, since the beginning with my first book, The Origins of Major War, is to try to look at what's true in the so-called opposing opinion or competing argument and try to integrate that into a larger, more synthetic approach to international relations. So, for example, globalization is clearly a phenomenon since 45, when the U.S. had very low connections to the world. The U.S. economy is now, I think, around 22% of its economy is based on trade. China, as I mentioned, is around 38, 39%, almost 40%. So those two particular economies are fully engaged in the world, and they hadn't been in their recent history. Maoist China, for example, had almost no trade with anyone because that was the strategy, keep it autarkic, as they say. And Deng Xiaoping's major change in the early 80s was to say, look, we can't grow. Look at history. We can't grow unless we do what the British and other states have done in history, and that is engage the world in trade. It increases our prosperity at home. It increases our competitiveness. It forces us to build quality products, technologically driven quality products, so that we can compete in fair markets at good prices. And that's what China, in some sense, has done. Yet the other aspect of this, of course, and this is another myth, I think, which is that China is solely, quote, a neo-mercantilist country. In other words, they completely focus on unfair trading practices, stealing technology and so forth to achieve their quality gains and their market shares. There's a big particle of truth in that. They do steal products, intellectual property. They do put up unfair restrictions, what are often called non-tariff barriers. When they can't put up tariffs, they restrict certain products from getting in, or they make companies like Ford and GM invest in big plants in China to get a foothold. And then they learn the technology and make their own cars on those models. There's no question they're doing that. But guess what? This is how the British did it when they, in the 18th century, had to compete against Indian textiles before India was a colony. India had the best textiles. They were called calicos. And the British put up huge tariffs and used these kind of mercantilist strategies to develop their own industries. And it worked. By 19th century, Britain was the dominant textile manufacturer, imported, of course, Southern cotton to make that work. And the Americans learned from that. Alexander Hamilton, not the one of the Broadway play, but the real one, he really looked at Britain and said, we are going to use that model. So he smuggled in British technology for manufacturing. He hired and lured over engineers, if you will, from these factories and gave them big bonuses, if you will, to immigrate to the U.S. And he set up manufacturing plants. He died early, but that kept going to the point where by 1850, 1860, suddenly there was a big competitor to the British. And that was the growing industrialized America. America got to a point, as Britain did, where it wanted free trade. But what is the lesson of those histories is that all states that want to rise to great power status typically have to have some selectively restrictive practices to build up their certain types of industries, like China's electric vehicle industry or its solar panel industry. I'm not begrudging them, in fact, but what we can do as response is restrict or put on counter tariffs when we know that they're not playing on a level playing field, that they are engaging in practices. For example, recently, China has been dumping, as the phrase goes, a lot of their products, which they can't sell at home because they've got this overcapacity and lots of extra inventory. And the dumping practices is basically like a fire sale. Hey, you know, 20% off from our products or 50% off from our products for the next 6 months. And that can really hurt American and European industrial producers or manufacturers. So those are easy fixes. You just counter tariff and they usually stop. But in the larger global sense, we are in a competition. We are in a global competition, very akin to pre-World War I, actually, where there are at least two now, China and the US, major producers and the Europeans who can compete around the world for their cars, for their solar panels, for their, you name it, whatever manufactured products. And it's up for grabs who's going to get the market share. And I think the U.S. will still have a very competitive edge. That's what the CHIP Act was all about, regaining our advantage in high technology under 15 nanometer chips. Nanometers is the size of the laser technology that they use. And it's a straightforward competition, but let's keep it competitive on the economic realm. That's my main point. If we can allow all sides, and that includes the Europeans, to have what I call relatively open or positive expectations of future trade. In other words, they think they're going to be able to get the markets and the cheap raw materials that they need to be competitive, then it's good because all states will grow, absolutely. They may suffer some relative losses, but if they grow absolutely, their economies are prosperous, they're happy at home, and that's good. So the mythology that is sometimes stouted that trade will keep the peace. Well, there's a big part of truth to that. And that is that if the expectations are positive, strategically inclined actors like China and the US will say, this is good for us. We can bind the other through trade. We can make them realize that their growth and their domestic stability is a function of trade, as we've done recently with China. And then they will cooperate on issues like Taiwan and promises she did in November that he has no interest in attacking Taiwan. As long as they don't declare independence, the Taiwanese will not be attacked.
That is
a good assurance.
That's the critical item right there.
Yes.
It's been axiomatic for years that democracies did not go to war with one another. In most cases, that was true. And I guess you and I could both proffer that countries that have healthy trading relations with one another, in all probability, will not go to war with one another, or they'll resolve their problems peacefully, or that's the very least we could hope for. But Dr. Copeland, it's been a fascinating topic, but I want to thank you so much for a very interesting and a very informative program.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me on, Bill. Anytime.
My pleasure. I'm Bill Miller. Thank you for joining us today on Global Connections Television.